welcome to episode 7 of the Rethinking Podcast. On today's episode, I'm talking to Joe Edelman. Joe's a philosopher, scientist, and designer who's thinking deeply about our current political moment and how our human systems are designed. On this episode, we talk about community, human nature, goals and values, and much more. I apologize in advance for a little bit of the background noise on this episode, but I think you'll enjoy it. Let's get into the show. Joe, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's great to be here, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd like to hear a little bit about your background. Where'd you go to school? What are you up to now? And sort of what took you from those two places? I'm interested in hearing about couch surfing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to Dartmouth College. I studied computer science and music and playwriting. It was actually around when I was working on couch surfing that I got super interested in. I had an interest actually even in college in economic systems and sort of the idea of new economic systems like gift economies or reciprocity, reputation economies. But my interest in it was like kind of at the sci-fi level, like, and I was actually, I was full of shit. Like, I didn't really understand the role. I didn't have a take on human nature, or understand that different conceptions of human nature lead to different conceptions of society or economy. I just had this very naive idea that like somehow, maybe the technology of money led us to have a certain kind of economic system and some other technology. You know, a lot of Bitcoin people believe this now. Some other technology would lead us to have some other kind of economy. And this is part of the thinking behind couchsurfing, which wasn't started by me, but when I joined it, I was really excited and the whole team was really excited at this idea that we were creating a gift economy or a reputation economy, and that this was going to change society in a deep way, and the internet and the possibility of having a reputation economy or a gift economy like couchsurfing and Wikipedia and so on would radically reorganize society, and many things that were currently done in a transactional way with money would be done in a different way. And we just sort of naively thought that the key to this was just the technology. Maybe we said some things about transaction costs to sound smart, but there was no philosophy, no microeconomics behind it. It was just kind of a naive idea about how technology affects society.
Sure. And so when you're building couchsurfing then, did you just sort of run into a wall where the technology stopped functioning as a way to get people to reorganize the way they worked and lived? Or what was the problem, because you were solving it technology first instead of human nature first?
Sure, yeah. We were really surprised when couchsurfing kind of hit a plateau at a certain point. It expanded pretty rapidly to 10 million users.
And maybe you want to talk about exactly what couchsurfing is for those who may not have heard of it.
Oh, sure. Couchsurfing predated Airbnb by a lot. It started in 2003. It's a way to travel and have people put you up as you travel. And couchsurfing, unlike Airbnb, the hosts weren't rewarded monetarily, but instead there was a reputation and review system and a kind of a economy that emerged from that, where hosts that hosted a lot of people that were very well regarded were kind of had a high reputation in the system. There were certain kinds of badges for getting a lot of positive reviews, and this meant that if you hosted a lot of people, you could travel and other people would put you up in extra special places.
Very cool. Right. So then when it comes to the way that affected human nature or was not able to, where do you think the sort of the problems ran into that technology could no longer solve, where you kind of had to go to this lower level, which we've been talking about and calling human nature?
There's a certain kind of cost-benefit analysis or choice-making that human beings do. And this really limits the sort of bounded rationality of the human, or the possibility of doing some kind of accounting of like, okay, well, I'm going to do this. It's going to take this much for me to do it, and that's worth it to me because I can kind of compare these two things as numbers or weigh them. this is part of what makes the money economy scalable and part of what makes it work, because there's kind of a promise to different products or services that you could buy, and you can kind of evaluate the quality and the potentiality of that promise. What Couchsurfing really offered people, what it was able to deliver that was really special, and still exists, and it still may be able to deliver some of this, was a kind of community and a kind of an access to many people all around the world. It wasn't an especially great place to find, if you just wanted to crash somewhere, it wasn't especially great, but if you wanted to meet new friends, go on adventures that you never would have gotten to go on otherwise if you didn't know a local, Couchsurfing was unparalleled. But this kind of thing is very hard for people to make choices about and see in terms of utility. And so some people that were already kind of very adventurous and already kind of had plans like this could see the potential of Couchsurfing and would understand to use Couchsurfing. But most people in most of their situations found Couchsurfing's promise a lot harder to evaluate than something like Airbnb's promise, which focuses on the space, which is much easier to kind of commodify and compare and contrast as a product.
Right. It's just inherently much more difficult to like commodify and quantify like the human experience, I guess, when you're staying with someone, if you go on an adventure and then someone else stays there, doesn't have as great of a time with the adventure. It's hard to sort of like have that all make sense to someone as they're looking at reviews of different places, maybe. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, that is. And I think, it's still kind of an unsolved problem, is that people need community. This is what I sort of figured out after Couchsurfing, is that people need community, and in fact we have a kind of an epidemic of isolation, or at least I would say so, in the US and in Britain. It's less true in Europe. But people don't know how to buy and sell and weigh community the way they can comparative shop, even for big purchases like houses and cars.
Sure.
And this makes it so that this makes it in general so that some of the things that we most yearn for and miss most, like community, love, adventure, and so on, the market doesn't coordinate solutions for those things because of the information requirements for agents and the information requirements for, I guess, what providers or sellers. It's kind of impossible to organize some of the things that matter most to people through the market.
Right. And is that just because these things like you're talking about, love, community, adventure, etc., are just inherently maybe unquantifiable, unmeasurable, ungoalable maybe? Or is this a solvable problem? We just don't have the technology yet that enables markets to solve these problems.
I think it's a solvable problem, but it's not about technology. It's about a certain kind of literacy. I think that we've learned to evaluate products and services and how they will further our goals. People are constantly forming goals at all different kinds of levels of abstraction, from just wanting to get to Colorado to wanting to become a philosopher or a programmer. And along the path to that goal, there's any number of different kinds of purchase decisions or other kinds of commitments that that people can make, kind of intelligent decisions about weighing off. Does it make sense to go to university to become a philosopher? Well, these are the pros and cons. And does it, should I use Google Flights to get to Cincinnati and so on? This is a kind of thinking that we're good at and that we've built a huge infrastructure to work fluidly within. And I think what we really don't have anywhere near the articulacy inside ourselves or the kind of fluid options required to figure out how to assemble ways to live by our values, to live in the kinds of communities they want, and so on and so forth. This is an area where it's harder. I mean, it's I think it's by nature harder, but it's not impossible. It's just very disorganized, both in our own minds, because we're less articulate about our values than our goals, and by the less articulate about the different kinds of practices that we do or communities that we're part of that help with our values. This is like not stuff that people are good at naming compared to the products and services that help with goals. So part of it is in us, and part of it is in a kind of missing ecosystem. And part of it is just that it's harder.
Right. So there's so much I want to get into there. I mean, when you say that we're worse at articulating, or it's harder to articulate our values than our goals, that sort of makes intuitive sense to me. Is that because that's just a harder thing for us to do, for any human being to do? Or does that have to do with the way we view human nature because of like these 19th to 20th century thinkers you've written about, like Adam Smith and David Hume, who sort of tried to understand human nature and write about it, and the way that sort of...
It goes back further than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, so my take, this is, I guess maybe... that the ancient Greeks were actually better at talking about values than modern people in the West.
Okay.
So this is kind of weird. Like, how did that happen? That we actually somehow got worse at it. When did we get worse?
And why do you think they're better at it? Why do you think the ancient Greeks would
be better? If you read Plato's Symposium or a whole bunch of other, plays dating from... Mm-hmm. The kind of flourishing of Athens, you hear a kind of conversation that I sometimes call in my classes sharing wisdom, that you don't hear in modern life. So it could be that the authors are just like all making this up, that it's not a true depiction of life in Athens. But I kind of feel like there's enough evidence, or there's enough different writers that write in this kind of style of conversation, that it would be very surprising if people didn't just kind of talk like that to some extent.
Right.
And the sharing wisdom, like what they're talking about is they're talking about different values or approaches in life that could be good or bad, or that they've learned about in this way that's very... Modern Westerners have, I would say, a confusion between values and norms. So people want to be good vegans, good Christians, good liberals, and so on. And they sort of have this particular idea of what they should stand for. They should stand for equality, or they should stand for the American way, or, you know, it's different depending on which subculture you're dealing with. And there, you don't feel, if you're trying to be a good Christian, you don't feel, for instance, like the way they talk or the way they seem to have maybe talked in Athens is something like, somebody would be like, I've decided that it's better to be ruthless. And so, you know, somebody else would say, oh, ruthless, that's interesting, because I think it might be better to be kind. And then they have this little debate where there's no sense that kindness makes more sense than ruthlessness. Like, it's just kind of like, here's our different approaches, and we're going to share the wisdom we learned. And there's no sense of something normative, that there's one way to be, there's a right way to be, there's a Christian way to be, or an American way to be. Nothing like that. And this would be very unusual today.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that I think philosophy as a discipline is good at, is sort of challenging those assumptions, right? Like, what does it mean to be ruthless? What does it mean to be kind? You know, those are questions you may not have asked yourself, that I think philosophers spend a lot of time and spill a lot of ink thinking about. But it does seem, I mean, as you talk about this, that when I've read, you know, these, you know, Socrates' dialogues or anything like that, that is what these people are talking about. But then when you skip ahead to today's world, and you think about the conversations we have with our friends and the conversations I have, you know, with my peers, they are much more goal focused and less value focused. And so what do you think the reason that's changed is?
So my best guess is that in medieval Christianity, There was, so I think originally, like early interpretations of Christ and the New Testament and Christianity seemed to be kind of values focused. Thomas Aquinas was like, seemed actually kind of open-minded in this way that I've been talking about the Greeks maybe being. But certainly the medieval church was a massive normative influence. Like there was one way to be a good Christian. And this is true both with like the Russian Orthodox Church, but also like the European medieval church. You know, you're supposed to have certain virtues: hope, faith, charity, love, and not have the opposites. So there's no right. debating the medieval church that, you know, actually marriage isn't really a good idea, or faith is always misplaced. If you do that, you're a heretic, or you're just a bad Christian. So my thought is that this began a confusion between norms and values, because it stopped being the case that people could just talk about values without the assumption that there was kind of a way that you're supposed to be. And I think this infected philosophy also, like Immanuel Kant, when he's like talking about what morality is, he's clearly trying to justify some things that I would call norms that are actually socially relative, like marriage. He spends some time justifying marriage, some time justifying private property and Critique of Pure Reason. Hume is also confused about this in a different way. Anyway, the philosophers were confused about this, but I think even more so, just like ordinary people starting from medieval times and going into the Enlightenment didn't really see the difference between norms and values. And social pressure was seen as kind of the right way to make a good society, whereas in ancient Greece, talking a lot about different ways of approaching things was seen as the way to make like a wise society. And social pressure was certainly used, but it wasn't seen as like the main way to make people good. So this is my idea about how, this is my best idea so far about how we got so bad at talking about values, is that we got confused about norms and values, and this shut down a kind of conversation which is necessary for people to become really articulate.
Right, and when you talk about people like Immanuel Kant or Hume, who you think are confused, but it sounds to me a little bit like they're maybe poking a little bit of a hole in this idea that norms and values are sort of like the same thing as maybe like the Christian church was saying. Like they sort of started to think maybe these things could be like pulled apart a little bit, but you've recently written a new series called The Next Enlightenment, where you're talking about maybe how there's another sort of revolution that needs to happen in terms of norms and values. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how that is traced from this Enlightenment that we were just talking about to maybe what needs to happen for us to sort of really pull these ideas apart.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's quite hard to pull them apart. I think it requires the creation of a kind of a subculture that talks the way that the ancient Greeks talked. And then this subculture has to grow in the same way that, say, around representative democracy and laissez-faire, an earlier subculture of kind of liberals and people who wanted to pursue their own goals without respect to what the church or the monarchy wanted them to do. It started as a subculture. It was had some intellectually elite people in it, and then there were certain moments, like in the U.S., the Tea Party, and other moments in France where this subculture was like, hey, this is our time. Like we can get a much larger population to buy into this idea of individual liberty and to throw off the monarchy and the church and so on. So something like that needs to happen, where at first a subculture gets really good at talking about their values and starts inventing institutions, structures, organizational structures for clubs and businesses and so on that are very values aware, that are values driven, and then looks for ways that this can actually kind of come into more of a mainstream setup. Is that?
Yeah, and that makes sense. Why do you think that this isn't happening or hasn't happened already, though? Is it just because we aren't, is this inarticulatability of our these values, or why isn't that happening?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that our society has just been really confused. So the philosophy that I based all my work on is a bunch of, it really started in the 1980s. So this is very recent. So there were these sort of movements. To go back to sort of the timeline that I was talking about before, I think that there was folks like Hume and Kant that were trying to make a new basis for something like morality. And then Nietzsche came around and he was like, it's all just norms, kind of, except he called them values.
Confusing.
but Nietzsche was like, you know, values are just made up. You can make up your own values or whatever. But what he was talking about, if you look at the examples he's given, are norms. So clearly Nietzsche still had this kind of confusion. And this led to, these like Foucault and Derrida and all these people who were like, all conceptions of value are just some kind of expression of power. So this was like a whole confusion that was going on in the 20th century. Another separate confusion was a kind of logical positivism. Let's stay objective. Let's worship science. Let's exclude these things that seem subjective from philosophy. And it was only, there was this third train, which is like the pragmatists, or the new pragmatists, Richard Rorty and Charles Taylor and people like that, that was trying to kind of keep some hope alive, Hillary Putnam. But it was only in the 80s that work was done that seemed to put human values back on a strong footing as a kind of knowledge about how to live well that that we needed and that we used to make choices and that we might as well study. And this came from work in the philosophy of action, the philosophy of choice. Like, once it was clear that people used something more or less like values to make their choices, right, and that this was a very important type of knowledge that you would make, that often people felt like they made worse choices before they learned value by admiring someone or something. But once that was recognized, then at least the analytic part of philosophy kind of, it really spread very quickly. But this was just in the 80s and 90s, and I think we're just beginning as a culture to recover from a mistake that's like 1,000 years old.
Right. I mean, the irony of all this to me is that it seems like these values that we're talking about are some of the most important parts of what it is to be human and to live a good life. I mean, maybe this is sort of tautological, but it feels true. Like, the things you mentioned, adventure, love, community, that seems to be really what everyone wants out of life. But it seems like, again, this is a thing we're not even talking about doing. So our goals then, and I'd love for you to tease a little bit apart this idea of goals and values, which you talked about recently, but are goals just a bad way of getting at values that just kind of works, right? Like, it's just like a cute, crude heuristic to kind of get us to values? Or are we just totally missing the point when we're talking about goals and just thinking in this goals-based framework?
No, I mean, I think goals, like plans in general, goals are a kind of plan without much, like an open plan. A goal is kind of an open plan, and plans are very important in terms of how we navigate the world. We have limited cognitive capacity, so we have to have, we have to make plans, and then we have sort of conditions under which we revise them. So, you know, I'm going to the birthday party, next week. If I get sick, then I might think of changing that plan. Otherwise, that's the plan. That's part of what lets you and me, you know, agree to meet there. So it's important for collaboration or cooperation, and it's what lets me plan the rest of my life around the idea that I'm going to the party or whatever. So that's true with goals too. That they're a very important part of how we operate. I think what was missed by certain economists, I mean, economics changed to a kind of a preference view in the mid-1800s. But before that, the original framing of microeconomics was around goals. And also the preferences view is kind of, in a way, even weaker than the goals view that they used to have. The problem is that goals aren't really what matters to us. Like, they're provisional, they're operational, but one of the things that I do in my workshops is I have people make a list of their goals and then a separate list of how they want to pursue those goals or what kind of character they want to be while doing those goals. So, you know, I want to start a company, but I want to do it creatively or with a spirit of inquiry or as a good leader. You know, so people have different kinds of values with which they want to pursue their goals. And this ends up being actually the important thing, and the goals end up being fairly replaceable. I mean, not completely replaceable, because once you have a goal, you build other goals around it, sub-goals and so on. So you can't just, it takes quite a lot of rebuilding when your goals have to change. But what's really motivating you to form certain goals is actually, in my view, the underlying values like leadership or creativity or the spirit of inquiry or whatever. And so we recognize something really important about goals, but in imagining that people are just looking at different, in economics, for instance, looking at different bundles of products and services that might forward them towards their goals, we're missing a larger picture.
Right. So when it does come to sort of like achieving, can you even talk about achieving values? Or, I mean, you can achieve a goal. What do you live out a value? How do you think about that?
That's right, yeah. One way to think about values is that they're improvisational directives. Here's two ways of thinking about values. They're the same, but it's hard to see that they're the same. One is that values guide us as we plan, act, socialize in a kind of an improvisational way. So, you know, if I'm talking to you, I'm maybe trying to be clear, trying to be honest, and these are things that I value, clarity and honesty. So these aren't really goals because there's not a point of, like, a particular outcome.
Right.
It's like a continuous guiding force. And then the other way that they're not goals is that I'm not evaluating myself based on what's achieved by being clear or honest. So if I feel like I was clear and honest, but you misunderstand me or you get really upset or something, I still feel proud that I was clear and honest. And in this way, they're very different than goals, where a goal has a particular end state, and if you don't achieve the end state, well, then you didn't achieve your goal. Whereas you sort of achieve values by living them out, and if you do that in a way that you can recognize in yourself, then you're satisfied.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So then when it comes to, I mean, we live in Silicon, or I live in Silicon Valley, there's a whole movement of like the quantified self, quantify everything. You can't quantify these goals, right? So when it comes to building technology that allows people to pursue their values, I said you can't quantify goals,
yeah,
you can't quantify values. When it comes to building technology, products, services, even living in communities that allows people to pursue these values, how do you think about doing that? Like, again, this is sort of coming back to the beginning of the conversation, but what does that look like? Is that just me sitting down and articulating what my values are and then sort of rethinking my goals around that new foundation that I have built? Or is this something that other people, other companies can do to help me pursue those values? How are you thinking about those two things?
Yeah, I think they actually can be quantified. it's just harder, a lot harder than the kinds of goal-based or engagement-based metrics that we've made so far. So one way to think about it is that because values are guide us improvisationally, when we're living out our values, we can say that there's a supporting group of maybe collaborators, friends, community, but also possibly products. Like if you value athleticism or something, and you've got this like fancy bike, and you're training for a distance bike race, and you've got a coach and a friend and all this stuff, all these things are kind of part of your practice of bike racing and support for your value of a whole bunch of values. And so there's another kind of accounting that's different than the kind of goal accounting. You'd somehow have to keep track of what kinds of setups people need to live by different values. What kinds of setups make the difference? So if somebody's, you know, unable to figure out how to be creative or entrepreneurial or adventurous or whatever, and another person is, you can start to maybe get a sense from data about what it takes to live an adventurous life. And of course, some of that's internal, but some of it's certainly external. And has to do with the kinds of setup you have. And so I think there's a kind of analysis that we can do, a kind of accounting for values and what it takes to support them, and for different practices which kind of relate to values in a deep way, that will eventually let us navigate, like let us figure out how to live by our values better. In a kind of a data-driven way.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds ideal. And one thing you've talked about before is how it's not that a change in materials or technology brings about a change in like ideas or human nature, philosophy, but it actually works in this opposite direction, where sort of these changes in ideas and philosophy, maybe values, are what then spur changes in materials and technology. And I think that's a little counterintuitive. So I'd like for you to talk a little about how that works and how maybe we're putting the cart before the horse when we think about technology driving philosophical change.
Yeah, sure. As I said in the beginning of the episode, I used to think the other thing. I used to be, Marxists think the other thing. They're economic materialists or whatever. They think that economic conditions drive history. And in general, so do technologists also think that. So they imagine that, like, you know, as soon as the pencil was invented, people could invent voting or something. And so as soon as the blockchain is invented, we'll invent some other thing. And I used to believe this. What convinced me was really just history and sociology, other people's work, especially Deirdre McCloskey at University of Chicago is an economist and an economic historian. Charles Taylor is a philosopher that I deeply admire. And both of these people did historical studies to look at what happened first. The Marxist or technological determinist or media theorist person like McLuhan or something would all imagine that first there was some kind of new technological change, and then you would see new ideas spreading after that. And when you look at history and you look at the details of the Industrial Revolution, different cities, where things started, where things happened, details of the prior revolutions for representative democracy, even things like communism, it doesn't work that way. What happens is that a book or an idea or a certain vision of what it is to live a good life or what it is to have a good society spreads, like earlier, quite a bit earlier, before the revolution. In the US, the book was Common Sense. And in France, it was the Declaration of the Rights of Man in the representative democracy kind of revolution. And these books spread earlier. Also, the Industrial Revolution started in Amsterdam and Scotland. And ideas like David Hume's actually spread before. And people read these books. They got quite popular in each of the cases that I mentioned. People read these books and they were like, you know, I'm my own king. I don't need a king or innovation. Like I can innovate. And they started looking around for ways to improve on technology because they read a book or something. And then the Industrial Revolution happened in that city before other cities. And so, I was just convinced by the historical data, which is overwhelming in the other direction.
Right. So what do you think that means then for like Silicon Valley, for innovators, for entrepreneurs, for companies? Do they need to start thinking more about values and philosophy in terms of how they want to develop successful products or products that, you know, change the world, like all these entrepreneurs in the Bay Area seem to want to do? Do you think they just have the cart before the horse? Or do you think that there is technology that can open up new fields of ideas? Like I'm thinking about like Couchsurfing, for example. I mean, you came on the team a little bit later, but it seems like that is maybe, you know, a technology, a website that then spurred this idea of, oh, maybe this is a whole new way the economy can work, rather than, you know, brainstorming a whole new way the economy can work and then building the website. I don't know exactly how that came about, but, you know, it seems like technology can open up these new landscapes of ideas, potentially. What do you think about
that? I don't think so.
Okay.
Certainly technology changes things, as especially speed of communication and speed of transportation leads to different spatial organizations, like railroads led to a very different organization of towns and so on. So I'm not saying that there isn't a difference made, but I think that the biggest changes, if people want to have, it depends on the scale of the kind of change that you want to have. And the biggest changes happen because of new views of human nature, because people read a different part of themselves and decide it's important. They get into their feelings and they want movies that affect their feelings and they want to see a psychotherapist or whatever, or they get into their goals and they decide to start a company or whatever, right? There's many of these, many examples of this. And I think if you want to do that, if you want to awaken people to a different part of themselves, a different way of seeing what a good life would be for them, you don't start a technology company. You might make a video game or something. You might make an experience. You would have written a book if it was 150 years ago. If it was 80 years ago, maybe you would have made a film. And today, you might make a book, a video game, a film, something else. It could even be like some kind of interactive storytelling. It could even maybe be some kind of personality app or something that shows your data, visualizes your life in a new way to tell you a story. But in each case, it's not going to be some kind of enabling technology like blockchain or trains. It's going to be something that leads people to see themselves in a new light, to change their idea of what a good life would be for them, what a good society that enables such good lives would be. It's going to be something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we spoke about this a little bit earlier, but you're releasing a new short series right now called The Next Enlightenment. And so I'm interested in what parts of human nature you think we are dormant right now. What parts of us have we not awakened that we haven't seen yet that you're excited about? And maybe it's not a question you can answer, but do you have any intuitions about things that we're just not clear about right now?
Yeah, it's about values. I mean, no surprise there.
Okay, right.
But I guess in general, one way to put it is that the postmodernists and some sociologists like Robert Sapolsky are really into a certain aspect of human society, which is which we could call social performance. So all the different ways that we act to fit in or to set a certain tone, like if you want maybe everybody's freaking out and you want people to be calm, so you perform a kind of calmness in hopes that everybody else will kind of calm down because of that. So this is a true, deep thing that human beings do. And many 20th century, especially mid-century kind of postmodernist philosophers and sociologists imagined that this was the whole story, that life is just kind of a performance and that you are doing different performances to shape power or social dynamics in different spaces in different ways. What I think they missed is that, or what's a rare ability currently is for someone to be able to introspect, notice all their performances, and then subtract that out from their motivations and see what other kinds of non-performative motivations they have. And I think if people do that, they discover that there's a whole other set of motivations that are deeply meaningful to them, that are not performances, that are not about affecting a certain goal or fitting in a certain environment, but that are just ways that they want to be. I refer to those as a person's values. And I think this is a skill, this capacity to notice your own performances and then do this kind of mental subtraction to see what other kinds of motivations you have that aren't performative. This is the next step that's my best guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do people do that? I mean, it almost sounds like meditation or just introspection, or maybe like tools that are useful in terms of like understanding what's performance, what are my deeper motivations. Do you have any sort of like practical sort of ideas on sort of how people can start to look at themselves a little bit differently?
Yeah. I have this class that's like 14 hours of exercises around this. One of the best ones is called Out of Character. This is a game where a lot of the class is group games. Out of Character is a game where people write first. You sort of journal at the beginning about how you try to be seen and how you're afraid to be seen. So, you know, I try to be clear when I speak. And then, okay, well, what does that mean I'm afraid of? I'm not afraid of being unclear, like being confusing. I mean, this is a little scary, but not super scary. But what's really scary, like I would really hate for people to think that I'm a fake or that I'm crazy, like schizophrenic kind of. Like this is like really scary to me. So I want to be seen as clear. I don't want to be seen as fake or crazy. And then we play a game where we are fake or crazy on purpose in a room. So we practice like negating the performance of clarity, if you see what I mean, like turning it around and accepting the fact that people are probably gonna see you as crazy or fake because that's what you're doing right now or whatever. You're being crazy, yeah. You're being fake, you're doing it on purpose. And once you do that, you notice that there are still good things happening. Like people are seeing you maybe as crazy or fake, or at least you imagine they are. But the world doesn't end, and there's some motivations, like I said. There's some things that are interesting to you and so on, even as you totally fail in all these performative goals that you usually have. And so this turns out to be a wonderful way for people to see what kind of norms they're trying to create or norms they're trying to comply with, and then sort of subtract those out and see what kinds of personal values are there beyond them.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds to me like improv comedy a little bit, you know? Like,
sure, yeah.
Those kind of activities, right. Yeah. Okay, so if people are interested in these ideas, I'd love for you to give a couple suggestions of resources where people can research more. So, you know, your Twitter handle, your Medium, but then any other, like, projects, initiative, websites that you're currently excited about. If you have any off the top of your mind, I think our listeners would be interested.
Yeah, so I'm scaling up this training program. And the goal is to have kind of two tracks. We currently have this track that we're calling the High Impact Program, where we're training a lot of folks at the big tech companies to see this difference between norms and values and to change how they design the social environments they design. So this is just for people in industry that are designing social environments. It's kind of a very niche class for people that might be designing, I don't know, VR spaces or chat rooms or email or all these different kinds of social systems. But then we're going to be opening up another class that will be cheaper, where you play some of the same games, and it's more about personal clarity, values, and norms. So that's one thing to watch. That's called Human Systems, and there's links to it on my Medium. And other than that, I think just my essays, and if you're interested in this stuff, go to the sources. So click through to the footnotes in my essays and read David Velleman, Ruth Chang, Amartya Sen, Charles Taylor, the people that whose work I'm building off of. They're the real philosophers.
Cool. I think this is a really wonderful conversation, Joe. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure thing. Yeah, my pleasure.